7:34 nearly. Efforts continue to get Japan to take full responsibility for its abuse of Korean women as sex slaves during the last century. These efforts have been ongoing quite literally for years. In fact, we just passed the 10th anniversary of the US unanimously approving a resolution calling on Tokyo to formally acknowledge and apologize. Even more poignantly, one of the three surviving victims who testified back then in front of American lawmakers, Kim Gun-ja, passed away at the end of last month, leaving only 37 known surviving victims in this country. Let's bring in a prominent voice from the time, who remains a prominent voice now, Ms. Mindy Kotler, Director of Asia Policy Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have gone back in the record and seen opinion pieces you wrote more than a decade ago now in relation to this issue. Can you share with us your memory of how this resolution came about?
Well, it was definitely an activity that was fully supported by the U.S. Congress. At the time, issues of human trafficking and women's rights were front and center. And it was bipartisan. And so when this issue came up, both Republicans and Democrats could empathize with the women and the girls that had been trafficked there 70 years before. So it was a timely issue.
Why did it happen then particularly? Because a few years before that, obviously, we'd had statements out of Japan which certainly had made some progress. But we also saw, around the time of this resolution, the rise to power of a certain Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Well, the Prime Minister Abe, actually, his negativism towards women and towards the historical issues, and his basing his whole political career on negating history, actually encouraged Congress and encourage people in the United States. They couldn't believe that someone was denying all the facts. So what had been a background issue, when paired with important problems of security and women's rights and human trafficking, Congress immediately realized that this was an important issue. And so they went back. Members of Congress went back at previous resolutions and re-examined them. And that's actually how I got involved, because they asked for some outside counsel and expertise. And I worked with members of Congress to put together a team of historians, political scientists, translators, and sociologists who are familiar with Japan and its colonial history. And so the congressman had a resource that could help them write a very effective and historically correct resolution that would be politically accommodating to how Americans think, as well as historically accurate.
When we look back, though, a decade ago, the testimonies of those surviving victims who stood up in front of Congress, the Korean and Dutch surviving victims who took part in that, can you tell us how important that was to the passage of this resolution?
That was critical. The room was packed, and it was quite a large room, and for the first time, they heard women talk about their experience, and not one, not two, but three, not just the Asian women, but a Western woman. And to hear that, to see that, to have these women tell their stories in their own words, in their own way, the room was captivated. It clearly made the complete difference and gave a face and an emotion to a historical issue.
But we're still seeing stories come out all the time, either questioning the evidence or feeling the need to establish evidence. I mean, even just this week, I saw a story with a set of clothes believed to have been worn by sex slaves working at a brothel in Japan being confirmed to have been government-made and coming out of the country's archives. This was reported by Yonhap, actually, just yesterday. And before that, recently, we saw footage of so-called comfort women emerge for the first time. Why is it that this sometimes is portrayed as a political question rather than just a matter of historical record?
Well, there is a certain political class which happens to be in power right now that has based its legitimacy on delegitimizing Japan's past and war record. And they are taking denier history and using it for political purposes, because that's what denier history is about. Denying helps them keep power. It helps them bring out small groups of voters and small groups of very wealthy men to come out to support these political candidates. Mr. Abe is supported by some of the worst of Japan's right wing. And so it's in his interest to feed that fire. So denier history is politically effective for the current administration.
So coming back to this resolution, despite being non-binding, it included strong statements, to say the least, describing this as one of the largest cases of human trafficking in the 20th century, obviously recognising it as a human rights issue particularly, rather than just a dispute between countries. How important was that side of this resolution?
That was the crux of what made this resolution so successful. In addition to seeing the women who had been affected by this, to show that this is a universal human rights problem, that it was not just confined to Korea, but it actually affected all women, girls, and boys throughout the Pacific region where Japan invaded, colonialized, they subjugated people wherever they went. And so that became a human rights issue. And really with the resolution, the most important words and the scholars that were involved will point to this word, and that's unequivocal. In Japan has given many, quote, apologies that look unambiguous. However, there's only been 4 Japanese government apologies that have been approved by the cabinet. And for a Japanese apology to be truly official, truly legal, and truly unequivocal, it has to be approved by the cabinet. And the Kono statement was not a single apology regarding the comfort woman has been. So that is really the importance of the resolution.
Yeah, well, and it's a very important point to make, because people still ask that question. How many apologies do there need to be, and how does this become?
It has to be approved by the cabinet.
Indeed. So, again, talking about the significance of the resolution, the fact that we're still talking about it more than a decade on, because we just passed the anniversary at the end of last month, what does that tell us?
That tells us that Abe and his political supporters are very wealthy and very delusional, and that they have put in millions of their own money and millions of Japanese state money to try to deny the history of the comfort women. And it's actually quite outrageous. We would never allow the Germans to do that, the Poles to do that, the South Africans to do that, the Cambodians to do that. You have the point where Japanese companies will not support or in any way or attend a program by anyone who has in any way supported the comfort women. The Japanese government and industry moves in lockstep, and that has the campaign against the comfort women has intensified. And it is about Japan unwilling to face its past and also unwilling to face what it does in how women fit in society. It was only until this year this year that crimes, that sexual crimes, it could get, well, that crimes that of, say you were stealing something, you would get more of a sentence than if you raped someone. That didn't change until this year. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just looking back in our recent history now at what you wrote on the day that the House of Representatives in the US unanimously adopted the resolution, House Resolution 121. And you wrote this, though, as well, in the piece that's available at washingtonnote.com still. You said, "I lament the many missteps and poor decisions made by the Bush administration. U.S. policy toward Asia is no exception. Although relations with Japan are believed to be going well, they are built upon a fragile base that masks a multitude of contradictions." Now, since then, we obviously saw U.S. President Barack Obama come out, now former president, and speak of the practice of sexual slavery as being egregious. But we've got a new president in charge now. How much progress or regression have we made since you made that comment about the Bush administration?
Well, even under the Obama administration, we allowed the Japanese to be content with their denier history. We would push back to some extent, but when it came to the 2015 agreement, we allowed them not to have an agreement. There is no one written piece of paper. There's simply two summaries of conversations. And with the Trump administration, they have no policy. They are dismantling our human rights policy. There is an interest in trafficking because Congress is extremely interested in trafficking, but there is very little connection to where security policy, human rights policy, women's rights policy is connecting. And so this Trump administration is giving the Abe government a free pass on it, on all its history issues, even for when President Trump has actually mentioned a number of times American POWs who were POWs of the Japanese, but he doesn't seem to make the connection that this is actually the 75th anniversary of the Bataan Death March and that there should be some sort of statement. So they don't seem to connect history with the current politics and the legitimacy of the Abe government.
Mindy Kotler, Director of Asia Policy Point, it's really interesting having you take us through this anniversary, but also the issues that clearly still remain for us under the present situation with Shinzo Abe. Interestingly, a decade on, still back in power, and with obviously a new US president in charge. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Mindy Kotler, as I said, of Asia Policy Point. You can have your say right now and contribute to this discussion and all of our topics this morning. Pound a sharp 1013 for 51 per message.